are less culpable and therefore deserving of more protection from the system. The system has failed Scott Panetti and his family because it has failed to protect him. It failed to protect him from himself.
Catherine Case, we're going to have to leave it there. Attorney for Scott Panetti, director of the Texas Defender Service, and Ron Hohnberg, thanks for joining us. National director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. That does it for the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate for Democracy Now!
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock, straight up. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday evening news coming up next. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, committed to helping our community's most vulnerable people for over 100 years and to giving them a hand up rather than a hand out. More information is available on the web at voaor.org.
Today is Giving Tuesday, a global day for giving back. On Tuesday, December 2nd, charities, families, businesses, community centers, and students around the world will come together to celebrate generosity and to give. Go to kboo.fm now and click donate.
Coming this Friday to the Song Circle, KBOO Community Radio welcomes esteemed singer-songwriter Jane Seabury, who in her more than 30-year career has garnered radio hits in her native Canada and a loyal fan following far beyond. Jane Seabury's in Portland to perform her holiday show, Holiday Hoes and Heroes. We'll talk to her about that and other recent artistic adventures, and she'll play some music live in studio on the KBOO piano. That's this Friday, 1:30 p.m. on the Song Circle, here on your community radio station, KBOO.
It's almost as if you could only crack the code, then you'd finally understand what this all means.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, graduate student teachers at the University of Oregon are preparing to go on strike.
Portland to consider withdrawing from the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
And the lights are back on in Detroit, Michigan. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2014. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock.
A meeting held by the Portland City Council will consider withdrawing from the involvement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The task force run by the FBI employs officers from over 100 cities nationwide with the means of responding to terrorist threats. Portland first joined the task force in 1997 with a focus on preventing threats to the Nike World Masters Games. The City Council formalized participation with federal anti-terrorism efforts in the year 2000. Since then, there have been concerns raised by local activist groups about the risk of civil rights violations. The League of Women Voters, the ACLU of Oregon, the NAACP chapter of Portland, and Portland Cop Watch, and the National Lawyers Guild have all voiced concerns about joining the group. Former police commissioner, now mayor, Charlie Hales, is a longtime skeptic of Portland's involvement with the FBI's task force. He said, "I'm concerned the JTTF is one more case of specialized assignments dealing with the threat of the month rather than dealing with the consistent issue of community policing." 2005 saw a vote to remove Portland officers from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Then Police Chief Tom Potter said regarding the decision, When we look at our history, we see examples that when we blindly give people power, that sometimes the power is misused. In 2011, Mayor Sam Adams and the City Council voted unanimously for police involvement on an as-needed basis.
The Columbia River is still fated to become a major throughway for coal exports, despite the sale of the main company pushing for the project. The controversial Australian firm Amber Energy recently announced the sale of their North American operations to a company called Resource Capital Funds. According to Amber Energy's president and CEO, it will not affect progress of two controversial coal projects that will transport mass amounts of coal from the Powder River Basin to Asia. The Morrow Pacific project can transfer more than 8 million tons of coal from a newly constructed terminal in the Port of Morrow to the Port of St. Helens. The other project, the Millennium Bulk Terminals in Longview, Washington, will see the construction of a 40 million ton coal export terminal. Environmental groups criticized the sale to Resource Capital Funds as evidence of coal's diminishing power. The Oregon Department of Public Lands has denied a key permit for the Morrow Pacific project. Representatives from Amber and the Port of Morrow are appealing the decision. A pre-hearing conference is scheduled for December 16th in Salem.
The Washington Department of Ecology has delivered a draft oil transportation study to the state legislature. The report was commissioned in response to the rapid increase of oil transportation by rail through Washington. The Marine and Rail Oil Transportation Study makes more than 40 recommendations intended to help protect the public and the environment from an oil train derailment or spill. Currently, about 30% of oil being delivered to Washington refineries travels by rail. The remaining 70% is delivered by tankers. The Washington Military Department's Emergency Management Division says 59% of the state's fire districts believe that they are not sufficiently trained, nor do they have the resources to respond to a train derailment accompanied by a fire. The report also contains a number of recommendations for the federal government. Unfortunately, the federal government preempts or limits the state's ability to set operational or safety standards for marine or rail oil transportation. The final oil transportation study report is to be delivered to the legislature in March 2015.
The Graduate Student Teachers Union at the University of Oregon went on strike today after over a year in negotiations for a new contract. The union issued a statement that they are disappointed that stalled bargaining forced them to strike. They say that this is their only recourse, as the administration continues to refuse paid leave for graduate employees. The administration has paid well over $100,000 on outside legal counsel to run bargaining with the union. According to the student teachers, the administration has pushed for language to cripple their health insurance, disempower the Health and Welfare Trust, and ramp up student fees on graduate employees. The amount of money their plans would have saved them would have more than covered their paltry original wage offers. The final unresolved bargaining issues are guaranteed paid medical and parental leave for every graduate employee and wage raises to the minimum salary to begin to close the gap between wages and the cost of living. We will have a full report on this strike featuring an interview with one of the graduate student leaders following this newscast at 5:45 tonight.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers. Members of United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America Local 279 at Weir Power and Valve in Ipswich, Massachusetts, have been on strike for almost 2 weeks. Local 279 President Kevin McPherson says the dispute largely comes down to the company insisting on contract language that would allow them to ignore worker seniority. With many workers working in the plant for more than 25 years, McPherson fears the company wants to replace them with greener, less expensive employees.
If they laid off employees, they wouldn't have to bring them back based on anything other than qualification. They wanted to be able to bring temps back in the building to do our job before members that are on layoff be recalled. So they basically want to be able to lay us off and have temps come in and do our job.
The union is also concerned about attempts to increase workers' share of health insurance premiums and issues of overtime, which McPherson says is taking a toll on workers' bodies.
towards the end of a 2.5-year period of 65 hours a week, injuries start piling up. We've had more injuries and accidents in the last year than I think the company's had in 20 years.
Human Rights Watch and the International Trade Union Confederation are raising the alarm about abuses and exploitation of construction and domestic workers in Persian Gulf countries. There are currently millions of migrant workers in the Gulf, mostly from Africa and Asia. In the United Arab Emirates, migrants make up over 90% of the workforce. A number of policies put these workers at the risk of a wide range of abuses, from non-payment of wages to verbal, physical, and sexual abuse. Nisha Varia, Associate Director of the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, says a lot of these abuses are encouraged by an immigration system called kafala, which ties migrant workers' visas to their employer, who must give permission for them to change jobs.
An abusive employer who is not paying their worker and who may be beating them up. This is the exact type of employer who's not going to give them permission to leave and work for another employer. Workers can get trapped in exploitative work situations, forced labor, trafficking, and there's nowhere they can go, and these lead to slavery-like conditions.
Domestic workers, mostly women, are particularly at risk of abuse, as they are excluded from most labor law protections. Gulf countries have announced some incremental reforms, but labor and human rights activists are often disappointed, saying the reforms are superficial and fail to tackle the root causes of exploitation.
They really need to abolish the kafala system to ensure that workers can change employers freely, provide comprehensive and equal protection to domestic workers under the labor law, and work closely with countries of origin to make sure recruitment practices are fair and ethical. Until then, we're afraid that the same level of abuse and exploitation will continue.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Last Wednesday morning, Portland park rangers were called to respond to a report finding dozens of dead and dying crows downtown. Along Waterfront Park, Lovejoy Fountain, Lonsdale Square Parks, and across the downtown area, up to 30 or 40 carcasses have been found so far. The regional arm of the Ecological Field Services Office said the agency is receiving crow carcasses from the Audubon Society of Portland and will make arrangements to send them to the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. The Audubon Society's conservation director, Bob Salinger, said he believes the birds were likely poisoned intentionally based on the discovery of corn found in the stomachs of the birds. Crows, among most native birds, are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. Any conviction resulting from intentional killing could lead to a $5,000 fine, 6 months jail time, or both. Conclusive results as to the death of the birds from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service could take up to a week or more.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos, recording from an Amtrak train, for a weekly statement on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I recently watched a documentary about the musical group Peter, Paul, and Mary. They were active both musically and politically for 50 years. They sang at the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. They sang at the rally to oppose the already built Diablo nuclear power plant in San Luis Obispo, California, that was built on an active earthquake fault. They sang for the United Farm Workers who were organizing to stop toxic pesticide spraying that was harming and killing farm workers. They sang for one major social movement after another for 50 years. As I watched this documentary, I could not help but notice a very sad truth. And this truth seemed to have entirely escaped the documentary filmmakers. None of the single-issue activism profiled in the film has been successful. None of it. The Diablo nuclear power plant in California is still operating. The farm workers still do backbreaking work and have few legal protections. Racial discrimination is still so bad that the number of black men being murdered by police officers now matches the numbers of black men who were being lynched a century ago. I could go on and on. Because of the work that I do, I happen to have an analysis as to why decades of single-issue environmental and social justice activism has been mostly unsuccessful in this country. The problem is that activist groups have been working entirely within a system of law that legalizes the massive harms caused by large corporations, and which distances we the people from having any real authority to govern ourselves. This problem did not go unnoticed by those citizens who witnessed it at the time. In fact, in 1994, more than 400 grassroots social movement leaders wrote an open letter to 15 of the largest environmental organizations in the country, pointing out that the problems that the environment was facing were structural in nature and could not be tackled simply by mobilizing the activist community, always in a defensive posture, one corporate harm at a time. Here is an excerpt from that letter sent in 1994 to the leaders of the 15 largest environmental organizations in the country. Some of us are associated with national environmental organizations, while others are actively engaged in community struggles for environmental justice and democracy. We are of diverse colors and backgrounds and include trade union and religious and electoral activists, as well as survivors of industrial disasters. What prompts us to send this letter to you is our conviction that you have not identified those subverting Congress as our real adversaries in the struggle to save our communities and the natural world, the leaders of today's giant corporations and the powerful corporations they direct. Not since slavery was legal have the laws of the land been used so shamelessly to violate the democratic principles we hold dear. The leaders of giant corporations govern as monarchs of old who claimed legitimacy under divine right theory. We believe that it is too late to counter corporate power, environmental law by environmental law, regulatory struggle by regulatory struggle. We don't have sufficient time or resources to organize chemical by chemical, forest by forest, river by river, permit by permit, technology by technology, product by product, corporate disaster by corporate disaster. But if we curb or cut off corporate power at its source, all our work will become easier. A century ago, corporate leaders convinced courts to transform our laws. Ever since, wielding property rights through laws backed by our government has been an effective, reliable strategy to build and sustain corporate mastery. If you do not write and talk about today's large corporations, if you do not educate and mobilize your members as you know how to do, our legislatures will face crisis after crisis. Corporate leaders will strengthen their grip on the law and escalate their takings across the earth. Together, we can end the nation's long silence about corporate power and manipulation. We can work together to save our democracy in order to save our communities and our natural environment. We want to meet with you to plan strategies for confronting corporations. This open letter was sent to the leaders of Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace USA, League of Conservation Voters, National Audubon Society, National Parks and Conservation Association, National Wildlife Federation, Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, Wilderness Society, Zero Population Growth, American Oceans Campaign, Center for Marine Conservation, Defenders of Wildlife, and Environmental Action Foundation. What was the response to this open letter sent by more than 400 grassroots environmental leaders? Only the Sierra Club had the courtesy to acknowledge receipt of the letter. Not one of the 15 biggest environmental organizations in the country ever responded to the letter or took steps towards becoming more focused on the structural causes of the massive environmental and social justice catastrophe that continues to unfold. 20 years later, these large environmental organizations continue to focus their work on one regulatory struggle at a time, one chemical at a time, one forest at a time, one river at a time, one permit at a time, one corporate disaster at a time. It didn't have to turn out that way. So the next time you wonder why our beautiful Mother Earth is in the mess she's in, you can thank our largest environmental organizations for their continuing refusal to address the structural causes of this endlessly growing crisis. And if you would prefer to put your time and energy into more effective activism, that is challenging the structures of law that allow corporations and the 1% to cause so much harm in the first place, I urge you to get involved in the community rights movement. I have posted a link to this open letter on my blog if you want to read the entire letter and see who these 400 folks were who signed it. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a report about the graduate student strike at the University of Oregon, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tis the season for ho-ho-homo holiday music. Tune in to hear Silent Dyke, I'll Be a Homo for the Holidays, Rhonda, the Lesbo Reindeer, and more. Daniel, our guest historian, joins us to share stories and music from Ronnie Gilbert, American folk singer and member of the Weavers. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low around 33. East-northeast wind around 14 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour. Wednesday, a 20% chance of rain, increasing clouds with a high near 44. Today in history, in 1823, President James Monroe rolled out the Monroe Doctrine, opposing European expansion in the Western Hemisphere. In 1990, American composer Aaron Copland died at age 90, and in 2001, Enron Corporation under CEO Kenneth Lay filed for bankruptcy. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani says that 93% of blacks are killed by other blacks, but remember that 47% of all statistics are made up on the spot.
It's 5:22 p.m. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Only a few months ago, President Obama announced the good news that our combat role in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history, would finally end by January 1. But put away the champagne, for a flock of screeching war hawks brought heavy political pressure on Obama to reverse himself. So our troops will stay in that war-ravaged, corrupt, bankrupted, ethnically divided country for at least another year or two. Amazingly, the hawks' argument was that Obama should not rush the timeline for training Afghan security forces to defend their own country. Rush? Hello, it's been 13 years. Operation Enduring Freedom, as this mess of a military mission was named, should be renamed Operation Endless War. Here we go again, not merely conducting training exercises, but also continuing to mire our courageous but overstressed military forces in the Afghan civil war, including using U.S. ground troops in combat missions against the Afghan Taliban. How many more Americans will die or be horribly maimed in that hapless land? How many more billions of our tax dollars will be dumped into Afghanistan's abyss? And why? Why are we there? Why are we wasting so many lives and so much of the money we desperately need here at home? And why are we the people not consulted on such a massive and momentous decision? It's reported that the Pentagon not only wants to keep troops there through 2016, but beyond. How many troops? What are they to achieve? That's a secret. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Obama announced last May that the U.S. would have no combat role in Afghanistan after this year, he said, quote, "It's harder to end wars than to start them." True, but being harder doesn't mean we can just surrender to those who are turning America into a militaristic state. If he won't fight them, we must. Go to peace-action.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown.
You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Detroit suffered a power outage today. Hundreds of traffic signals were down. More than 80 Detroit public school buildings were without power. Most police stations and 36 city fire stations were operating on generators. We spoke with Valerie Van De Pan, editor-in-chief at Detroit's Metro Times, to find out more.
So tell us about what happened. The Detroit lighting department suffered a massive failure today?
It did, and I think 75% of the city was dark for most of the day.
Wow. Now, and of course, that's the city's lighting department as opposed to Detroit Edison, which handles much of the rest of the city.
Yeah, in the metro region. The city of Detroit has about a little bit less than 650,000 people. The metro area has about 4 million.
Okay. And so power is coming back on, though, I take it.
It has been, according to the last press release, which just landed in my inbox, it has been fully restored as of right now, maybe within the last 30 to 45 minutes. So at about end of day Eastern time, Tuesday, it was all back on.
Fantastic. And now Detroit has been operating with an emergency manager because of the city's bankruptcy. Kevin Orr, tell us about Kevin Orr and what just happened.
Oh, goodness. Kevin Orr has been our emergency manager, which means that we're the only state in the union right now that has a situation where the governor can supersede the democratic process and appoint someone to run a city for the people. So even though the people of Detroit have elected a city council and we have elected mayors, they have not had any power, and it has really been this man named Kevin Orr who has been running the show here in Detroit. What's interesting about Kevin Orr is that Kevin Orr is a bankruptcy attorney from a bankruptcy law firm that is well known, Jones Day. So while he was hired and put in power by the state of Michigan, by the governor, Rick Snyder, who's a Republican, the bankruptcy law firm that handled the bankruptcy for the city of Detroit was Jones Day. So he left Jones Day to become our emergency manager, and then the bankruptcy firm he was basically negotiating with was the same law firm he had just left.
Just a little bit of a conflict of interest then.
And you might perceive that. So essentially the city negotiated its bankruptcy. Bankruptcy was finished this fall, and now Kevin Orr is preparing to leave. And he's apparently looking very much forward to getting back into the private sector. Referring to himself in the third person, he said it's time for Kevin Orr to put more steaks in the fridge and line his pockets in the private sector for a while. So he is he's very much looking forward to leaving, and is said to be putting in his resignation within the next week or two.
And the announcement of his resignation, this statement about steaks in the fridge, happened when?
Oh, today, about the same time as the power outage.
I take it he was in a building that wasn't affected by the power outage then.
Yes, he was in Oakland County, which is a very wealthy community just outside the city of Detroit, and the power outage was actually in the city of Detroit. So,
okay, so at least he was able to stay warm.
He was fine. He was fine, and apparently, according to a journalist from the Detroit Free Press, the power outage was caused by the failure of a cable that was over 50 years old. So, even though Kevin Orr is gone, clearly, we still have a number of problems here in the city, amongst, obviously, infrastructure.
Wow. All right. Well, Valerie Van De Pan, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, Doug. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Reporting for KBOO News, this is Doug McVeigh.
A judge in Florida issued a temporary ban on citations or arrests for a controversial ordinance that outlawed most food sharing in Fort Lauderdale public parks. A number of residents have been arrested in recent weeks for feeding homeless people. Because of Tuesday's decision by the judge to ban enforcement for the next 30 days, seven people who had been on hunger strike to protest Fort Lauderdale's ordinance could finally celebrate with a meal. Desiree Lynn is with Tampa Food Not Bombs. FSRN's Sean Kinane spoke with Lynn right before she broke her hunger strike.
You're about to break your hunger strike. Tell us what that was for and why you're breaking it.
The hunger strike was in response to the city of Fort Lauderdale's passing a series of ordinances. They've been termed homeless hate laws that were making houseless activities impossible, making life more difficult. And amongst other things, we were protesting the food sharing ban, which prohibited outdoor food sharing. So this was our response to that and our protest to that. And today there was a court hearing and a 30-day injunction was passed on the enforcement of that ordinance. So the seven hunger strikers currently are about to break their hunger strike.
How long has it been since you've eaten?
9 days.
Tell us about yourself and the other people who are on the hunger strike and Jillian Pym, who broke her hunger strike.
Jillian Pym is with South Florida Food Not Bombs. She was on hunger strike for 24 days. A sharp decline in her health caused her to step back from the strike, and seven people took the strike from her. And it's been difficult. I've lost 7 pounds in 9 days. What we all went through, we all know that is nothing compared to what, you know, the struggling community in Fort Lauderdale and cities all over the country are going through. We're happy that we can break the hunger strike. We're happy that people won't be criminalized for sharing food, but by no means is this over, and by no means does it lessen at all the suffering of the people in Fort Lauderdale. So I'm happy that the judge did the right thing, but I hope that the city of Fort Lauderdale actually takes steps now to address in some meaningful way the suffering of the people that need them the most in their community.
Is there any way to tell if the judge was influenced or if the city is being influenced by your actions?
I don't think there's a way to tell, because I don't think that they're letting it be known that they're being affected by the resistance that's being waged against them. I don't see that there's any way they couldn't be. They've disgraced themselves globally. All eyes are on Fort Lauderdale. People are shocked that they're citing and a 91-year-old veteran could face prison over sharing food like he's done for over 2 decades. So I think they've disgraced themselves. I don't think there's any way they couldn't be feeling pressure over what's going on. So, they're not showing it, but I don't think there's any way that it couldn't be affecting them.
And finally, what do you hope will happen next?
Like I said before, what I hope happens now, unlike the people that are on the streets in Fort Lauderdale, I can eat now. I don't have anything stopping me from being able to get a meal. The people that are struggling down there in the same position that they have been all this time, we're just asking that the city take steps instead of criminalizing people that are providing social services, instead of making life impossible and compounding problems for the struggling communities there. We're asking them to take action, something real, to fix the problems, to address the root problems of mental health, veterans with PTSD, the physically disabled, children, families, joblessness that are causing homelessness in their community.
That's Desiree Lynn with Tampa Food Not Bombs. Sean Canan, FSRN, Tampa.
The Ferguson Police Department is investigating whether they would like to press charges against Michael Brown's stepfather for his actions prior to the fiery riots in Ferguson, Missouri last week. In video footage from the minutes following the acquittal of his stepson's killer, Lewis Head is seen inciting a group of demonstrators outside the courthouse while screaming phrases such as, "Burn this bitch down," and "Burn this mother something down," to the crowd. Ferguson, already tense from weeks of awaiting the grand jury's decision, erupted following the announcement of police officer Darren Wilson's acquittal in the killing of Michael Brown. Within hours, a row of businesses on West Florissant Avenue, a major thoroughfare in the St. Louis suburb, were engulfed in flames. Police cars and dozens of vehicles at a nearby dealership were also set aflame. Police Chief Tom Jackson said that they intend to follow up on comments made by Head, and while no formal charges had been filed, the investigation is ongoing, with multiple law enforcement agencies involved. Jackson also said that they plan on prosecuting any and all people responsible for the loss of property and livelihood during the Ferguson riots to the full extent of the law.
The first in a series of town hall meetings around the country between U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and local leaders, law enforcement, and the public filled the pews at Atlanta's historic Ebenezer Baptist Church on Monday night. President Barack Obama called for the meeting after a white police officer killed an unarmed black youth in Ferguson, Missouri, sparking public outcry both locally and nationwide. Last week, a St. Louis County grand jury announced that it would not charge Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, sparking renewed protests around the country. For more, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
The first in a series of town hall meetings around the country between U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and local leaders, law enforcement, and the public filled the pews at Atlanta's historic Ebenezer Baptist Church Monday night. President Barack Obama called for the meetings after a white police officer killed an unarmed black youth in Ferguson, Missouri, sparking public outcry both locally and nationwide. Last week, a St. Louis County grand jury announced that it would not charge Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, sparking renewed protests around the country.
Now, while the grand jury proceeding in St. Louis County has concluded, I can report this evening that the Justice Department's investigation into the shooting death of Michael Brown, as well as our investigation into allegations of unconstitutional policing patterns or practices by the Ferguson Police Department, remain ongoing and remain active.
U.S. Attorney General Holder also said that following a review of military equipment used by state and local law enforcement agencies, the White House is drafting an executive order aimed at ensuring that police agencies are not developing a militarized culture. And he reiterated President Obama's statement on police accountability and reform.
And he announced a commitment of more than $263 million to support a three-year initiative that will invest in 50,000 body-worn cameras for everyone in this nation, expand training for law enforcement agencies, and add more resources for police department reform, and multiply the number of cities where Justice Department leaders facilitate greater engagement between residents and local authorities.
Holder's remarks in the church where Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once preached were met with applause, but so were many rousing speeches from community leaders and local residents. Among them, Atlanta spoken word artist and activist Ariel Lucier.
Let it be made known now, if it hasn't been said before, that black lives matter. We do not argue that all lives matter, but all lives are not killed every 28 hours without justice. All lives are not shot down in the streets unarmed. All lives do not have to answer to their own murders as if they are the perpetrator.
Lucier said the platform she was occupying was open thanks to the actions of young residents in Ferguson who refused to let Mike Brown become another statistic. Before she ended her remarks, Lucier brought attendees to their feet.
I stand with those young people as an organizer. I stand with those young people as a black queer woman. And I say, what are you willing to sacrifice for your freedom? I need you to stand now if you have ever feared your life. I need you to stand now if you have ever feared for your son or daughter's lives. I need you to stand now if you say, this is not a day to pat ourselves on the back and say, what a good job we've done, but a day to call into question a nation that lets its children die every 28 hours and not ask enough questions.
Writer, filmmaker, and former MSNBC analyst Goldie Taylor also spoke at the forum. An Atlanta resident for decades, Taylor originally hails from St. Louis County.
What we lived under in St. Louis is nothing short of an American apartheid. Where traffic tickets were used to suck wealth out of a community, to suppress a people, to let them live in fear. The state of emergency wasn't called in August. I've lived under it my entire life. For generations, we have lived under a state of emergency in St. Louis. So I ask you, where were you when?
As her remarks came to a close, Goldie Taylor said the organizing in reaction to the Brown shooting is also preventative.
If we don't change something now, if we don't gather ourselves and come to our senses and make meaningful change now, that means registering to vote, because that's who's sitting on the grand jury. Answer the jury summons. If we don't make this change now, the next Michael Brown could be my son Josh Taylor, or my son Thomas. The next Mike Brown could be your son, or your son. The next Mike Brown could be a young woman. And so, lest we forget, what brought us here. Let us leave away with one thing in mind, that the issues remain where they are. Let them be justice. Thank you.
Outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to announce new federal guidelines on racial profiling in the next few days. More regional town hall meetings will follow. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
According to the FBI, there were 461 justifiable homicides, quote-unquote, in the United States in 2013. This number is low since many police departments do not report to the FBI's database. According to the website 538.com, the actual number is over 1,000. That number comes from browsing various news reports. By way of contrast, Canada has about a dozen police shootings a year. Germany had only 8 in the past 2 years, and in Great Britain last year, there were none.
Ashton Carter is the leading candidate for Secretary of Defense, says three administration officials close to the president. Under a condition of anonymity, as the president's selection is not public, these officials confirmed earlier speculation that Carter is one of the only remaining candidates. This comes after two of Carter's rivals for the post, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Michel Flournoy and Senator Jack Reed, took themselves out of the running. Carter, unlike his predecessor Chuck Hagel, has ample experience within the Pentagon, taking his first position as an assistant to the Secretary of Defense during Bill Clinton's first term. Citing Carter's record as Deputy Defense Secretary, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said that he is certainly qualified to be defense secretary and is on the president's short list. He also noted that the Senate unanimously confirmed Carter in his previous position as deputy defense secretary.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2014. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, injures 5 civilians and kidnap 3 others. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Five residents were injured on Tuesday midday when Israeli troops invaded the village of Ya'bud near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Local sources reported that troops stormed the village and searched shops at a local market, then attacked shop owners. Later, local youth clashed with invading troops who responded by firing tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. As a result, 5 civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Earlier on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 3 Palestinians in Wadi Fokin village, west of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, and searched a number of homes. In addition, soldiers invaded Taqwa village, east of Bethlehem, broke into the home of resident Jum'a Abdel Khalil, and took pictures of his property and his sons Muhammad. In other news, several Israeli military vehicles invaded Tuesday Masayif Yatta and Al-Mufraka Bedouin communities south of the southern West Bank city of Hebron and handed destruction orders against the residential tents and structures. The coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in southern Hebron, Ratib Jabour, said that soldiers handed orders against the residential tents in Masafer Yatta and 3 tents in Al-Mafraka near the Tawani area. Soldiers also photographed an elementary school in the area, an issue that raised fears among the residents that the army intends to demolish it. Last month, the army demolished and removed a number of residential structures, sheds and barns in the area and handed orders against several tents, barns and water wells in a number of communities near Yatta.
You're listening to the Cable Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Logan Manser, Nicole Weinstock, Jared Dantzler, and Jim Thompson. Special thanks to our engineer, Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look out for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected rep...
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, we'll hear another installment of a teach-in on why technology will not save the world with speakers David Ehrenfeld on de-extinction and its residue problems, Doug Tompkins on technology and nature slash clash of concepts, and Wes Jackson on nature is the final measure. At 10, Chris André hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the KBOO Bike Show explores the life cycle of cyclocross in the United States. They speak with Lawrence Malone, a.k.a. the godfather of cyclocross racing, about the sport's humble origins in the U.S. and what it is like to be the lone American on the starting line overseas in the early years. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. December is a great time to give to KBOO as we move into the new year. Just go to kboo.fm. And stay tuned now. A report about the graduate student strike at the University of Oregon is up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.